This is day one of a three-part series, really to walk you through some of these steps that we can really take. So we've named day one the shift, and we really want to go through both perimenopause and menopause and really be able to identify where you are inside of these two phases and what shifts we can really make from here. So to give you an overall game plan of what we're going to cover, today we're going to really dive into belly fat and understanding menopause as a whole. Through a lot of the comments inside of the group, this was something that was super prevalent, and we just want to really explain why that's happening and what some of these tweaks are going to be. From that, we'll dive into, on Wednesday, sleep and understanding the seven system spoilers. These two areas be super interesting in just getting your body and energy back on your side through understanding some of these deeper health anchors, and we'll identify exactly what they are and what are some of these steps that you can take to improve them. And then lastly, day three, and my favorite, we're going to dive into how to never let willpower be your obstacle. If you feel like you're lacking motivation, you feel that you're constantly needing more willpower to stay on track, then day three is going to be a really nice way to wrap these three-day series up by making sure that this is a game plan that you can rely on and it really will last long term. Okay. So before we get underway, I do really want to make sure that, you know, we put a lot of effort into the slides today, and we really want to make sure that they're as beneficial as possible for you. And it's very much you're going to get out what you put in. But I want to make sure that we can personalize this conversation as much as possible to who we have in the room. So just before we get underway, I want to see where you're really based on this chart. So one would be, you know, my energy, my menopause symptoms are getting really bad, and that's really getting in the way of my day-to-day life. And if you're at a five, you know, you're feeling pretty good, you're feeling pretty healthy, you're just looking to find the edge or finding where maybe that 5% that I'm missing is. If you could just write 1 to 5, where you feel within those steps, you might be sitting right now, just so we can personalize that depending on what we're seeing come through in the group. You're more of a five, you feel that things are super healthy, you're tracking along really nicely, you're just looking for that edge, or you're noticing that symptoms are starting to get really in the way of your quality of life, how you show up on a day-to-day basis. What are we seeing come through there, Mandy?
Lots of fours, some threes, okay. A couple of twos, some five straight at the start, threes, one.
Quite a range, yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen 1 5.
Yeah, the fives jumped right in at the start.
Yeah. Overachievers are here. Good. and also clients, which is cool to see. Brilliant. And twos, threes. Okay, so quite a wide range, and I think today is really personalized to that, Mandy. So we'll make sure that both ends of the spectrum we are sort of addressing and making sure we can help you no matter where you are. So thanks for that. So really to go through what we're going to cover today, big focus, just to zoom in a little bit, is we're going to go through a huge metabolic shift that happens through perimenopause and really continues through menopause that I think most women are not aware of. And it allows us to feel like you're eating for your biology now, not 20 years ago. And I think that's going to be a nice way to really just shift your perspective on simplifying nutrition and some of these tweaks to really move through. I think overall, starting to look at this as being a supporting phase rather than a forcing phase is a really nice way to look at this, to make sure that we're working with our body, not feeling like it's a clash at every corner. And then lastly, we'll dive into what we call health anchors and really just start to uncover a little bit deeper what's really going on, start to look through hormones in a very different fashion. We're all aware that progesterone, estrogen, and testosterone are here and changing. But what's really going on, and what are some of these dips and dives that are happening that are causing the issues that are coming through? And more importantly, what are some of the shifts that we can make from here? So Mandy, I'll let you kick things off with perimenopause and we'll circle back around. But do you want to walk me through this window that's how we mentioned before?
Yeah, so perimenopause is the technical name for the time leading up to menopause, which is when you actually, a year from the date you have your last period. And this can be up to 10 years, this can be happening prior to menopause, but actually for some people it may even be a touch longer than that. So it is the time that we go from having regular cycles, or relatively regular cycles, and it all changes as it all winds down. And it is very much a time of significant hormonal fluctuation, which is what contributes to all of the metabolic changes that we have in our body and then all of those symptoms that we see coming through in that time frame. And it's what is really interesting about this kind of patch of time is that it is a time when we can actually, if we understand what's going on, we can support our body to go through it a whole lot better and just really minimize some of the things that we're going to experience through that time, but also minimize some of the ongoing potential things that could, you know, long stream impacts of going through that change. So it's very much a window of time that we can actually make quite a big impact on our health over the long term. So I want to, I really, really like this slide because it shows you just exactly this patch of time. And like we talk about menopause all the time, right? We kind of know that it's a thing, but it's a little bit eerie fairy. So this really kind of exemplifies what this transition is. And if we look here, starting back at childhood, you know, hormones are all very low. And then going through puberty, there's this real elevation in estrogen first until we get regularly cycling. Then once you're regularly having a cycle, progesterone is that dominant one that is really high. And that's the one that kind of keeps our symptoms more moderate. Then as you come into this years of perimenopause, progesterone drops off because you're no longer ovulating regularly. But in the ratio, estrogen is much, much higher. So that's where a lot of those extreme kind of symptoms are coming through. It's because of that declining progesterone because we're not ovulating, and then that extreme rises in estrogen as it also declines off. And then we can see in the menopause years there that progesterone basically kind of just goes away to nothing. Our adrenal glands continue to make a small amount of progesterone, but our ovaries don't. And then our estrogen just stays quite low. Again, our body has ways of making some, but our ovaries are not producing that significant amount that they are through our fertile years. So I just quite like that picture because it really kind of, it really shows that little patch of time that we're talking about and some of the extreme variation that we can see there.
Yeah, and you put a video up on this earlier in the week, Mandy, that I think explained it really well as well, right? Like we're coming into a menstrual cycle or a menstrual phase, and then we're coming back out of a menstrual phase. And the freedom that kind of comes with that, kind of getting back to your inner child and getting an awareness of some of these hormones and obviously the transition that needs to happen. And this is the phase that we're really talking about, is how can we minimize or be aware of some of those symptoms coming through, be aware of why it's happening, and then how can we make sure that it is a smoother landing rather than a plane crash. And I think that was a really nice way of putting it.
I like the idea of it being, it's referred to now as second puberty. Basically, mm-hmm. We're kind of going back to almost levels that we had like a child. And I think it's a kind of quite a freeing way to look at it because it can sort of feel very unnatural to what we've been used to for, say, 20 or 30 years of having regular hormone or high hormones. But our body actually knows what it is to be at that low hormone state, and it's actually designed to be able to function perfectly well at that lower hormone state. It's not an abnormal place or a disease place or a problem place. It's something our body is designed to do. We just need to support it into getting back to knowing that that's how it is supposed to be again. So I quite like that kind of, that it is quite a freeing way to think about it.
Yeah. And there were two points that are kind of side tangent on this, but we brought up earlier today or discussed earlier today, is understanding the relative difference in progesterone to estrogen and even both those hormones in comparison to testosterone, right? And we all think of males and having much higher testosterone than estrogen. But if we look at it in relation to what's happening on the female side, if we look at estrogen and testosterone of females, we actually females have more testosterone than estrogen present. It's just the ratio is much more skewed in the form of estrogen. So that was super interesting to come through. But you also mentioned that in this particular chart, we've got them on the same chart because it's easy to understand what's happening. But if we were to put them on a relative scale, estrogen would still be, you know, a little blip in the radar.
Yeah, progesterone, we make like orders of magnitude more of progesterone in reality, but to be able to put them onto one chart, we have to make it kind of look relative. But actually, if that was an accurate like two scale model, estrogen would just look like a flat line compared to those bumps of progesterone. So progesterone we make a lot of, and then if you put pregnancy into that, it's even like higher again. It's quite amazing how intricately our bodies are wired.
Yeah. So I just want to bring that up, just slight tangent for today, but wanted to make sure you're aware that a lot of these are obviously working in conjunction with each other. And when we see these drops in progesterone, they're pretty significant, and they're certainly going to show some impacts. Cool. This is part of a study.
Yeah, this one is really one that got Ollie and I thinking on this. The lady who's done this research here, she's one of sort of like the foremost researchers in this whole area of the menopausal, perimenopausal change, and actually changes that happen in our body during this stage due to the changing in hormones. And one thing that they've noticed, and they've noticed this through rat studies, but they've also been starting to look at this in humans as well. And in this particular aspect, humans and rats are very, very similar, but that is that during this time of perimenopause, as our body is adapting to using different fuels and not using fuels that maybe we've used in the past so well, our brain actually goes through an energy crisis to the point where it's almost in starvation mode. So this is where we see these things like brain fog and forgetfulness and stuff like that coming through. But what actually can happen if this goes on is that our brain will actually start breaking down its own cells in order to feed itself. The word is cannibalizing, which is just quite shocking to the system, but our brain actually breaks itself down in order to fuel itself potentially through this time, unless we are able to shift the food we're eating to really help our body through this stage. So our brain, primarily it likes glucose for fuel. That's the fuel that it seems to run the best on. Our brain is incredibly hungry. It's a very small percentage of our whole body, but it uses a massive amount of the energy from food that we put in on a daily basis. And so if our brain has been running on glucose for most of our life, as we go through perimenopause, it can no longer access that glucose as well for various reasons, which we will talk about soon. But that means that it basically gets hungry. And then damage can happen, and that can lead on further down the track to more and more brain fog and more of these kind of perhaps mood symptoms coming through, or even in the very long term going into things like dementia and Alzheimer's and stuff like that. So we really need to be understanding how this fuel shift needs to happen so that we can support the brain in particular to minimize a lot of those symptoms.
Yeah, and this study, although we brought this up and it kind of got us ultimately building this entire workshop to really go deep into what that really means, we've been noticing this for years with clients, right? With some of the shifts we make nutritionally, the lack of access to, access energy or be able to make those shifts, consistent energy through the day. And although this is typically for perimenopause and that window coming through, we have the opportunity to shift or need to shift how we fuel our body. And I want to go through potentially what that looks like through that phase. But knowing how it applies to the brain and knowing that as a pretty vital organ of the body, how much that is limited in our body's ability to utilize that fuel now, I think is really important to understand, because we're what used to work is simply shifting quite significantly as well. Mm. So the big one, yeah, as Mandy mentioned, right, this is a very recognized window of time, that sort of 2 to 10 years. And very much this comes down to nutritional and lifestyle interventions, right? Making those shifts to really improve our quality of life and knowing that we do have control of that space is hopefully something that we really dive into today, because it's no longer and there'll be hormonal shifts and there may be other interventions that we'll take, but hopefully through this lens, it allows you to make changes like today to look at this through the lens of what you can change right now. So a big one for us right now is potentially, especially if you rated as a 3, 2, or 1 on the scale, you can feel like your body feels a bit like this car right now, is your body is sort of bogged down with the certain stresses and obligations of life and feeling like the body's just not really working with you anymore. You feel like body fat is shifting or not shifting. You feel like you're eating foods, but your body's not utilizing that anymore. And you're forgetting your keys, or you just don't feel like you're as sharp as you used to be. There's obviously a reason behind this, and hopefully we can start to dive into that a little bit more. So that specifically went around this topic of perimenopause, but really this ties into, as with the overall chart we mentioned, is what those changes really look like a little bit deeper down. And specifically, as we mentioned in the group, and we really wanted to make sure we built this out based on what we saw inside of the Facebook group, was these body fat shifts, right? Where historically you noticed that there was more body fat around potentially thighs or hips. We're now seeing more of that come around our waist, or maybe we didn't have to worry about body fat before at all, and now we're noticing that it's becoming a problem, right? And there's some significant changes that are coming from these hormonal shifts, one, but obviously the lifestyle and nutritional changes that aren't changing that need to from there as well. So we're going to take this from a bit of a different angle, Mandy, is, you know, you think we're going to talk about estrogen and progesterone straight away, but we really want to just discuss this role of testosterone. And knowing this was a study you dove quite deep into, let's dive into what this looks like.
Yeah, so we want to obviously link this back to that fat storage thing particularly, because that is something that is just pretty much, I think it's like the second most prominent symptom that women complain of or mention during perimenopause and menopause, is that they just tend to gain weight around their middle. And I want to explain a little bit of why this happens before we get into some of the things we can kind of look to change and do about it. But one of the main reasons why this happens is, as our estrogen is dropping off, what the body actually does is it increases our production of testosterone for a time. And the reason it does this is that testosterone inside the cells can be converted into estrogen. So where our ovaries are no longer making estrogen, inside of our cells can actually still get access to some level of estrogen by converting testosterone to estrogen. But the trouble with testosterone for females is that it is quite a... it's called an androgen, and men's bodies tend to do better with it than too much, well, women need it, but too much in women does tend to mean that we will store weight more around our middle, where estrogen tends to potentially be more weight gaining around, you know, bum and thighs and stuff like that. So this, the body upregulates the amount of testosterone that it makes, but also because estrogen and progesterone are dropping and we already had some testosterone to begin with, it means that the ratio of our testosterone to estrogen is also changing. And what this is called is, it is called a move towards a more androgenic body shape, basically. So we move more to storing body fat, a little bit like a male does. So this is a big part of why women might store weight on their belly where they never may have stored body fat before. And it's not really something you can change because your body is upregulating testosterone for a reason, but it's more that we want to make sure that we're metabolizing those hormones really well, clearing them from our body if they're in excess, and eating to support our body fat in that, and our body weight and muscle mass and all that in that respect, which takes us on to the next point, which ties in very closely to testosterone, and it is the role of insulin when it comes to belly fat. So estrogen is a very, very cool hormone, and one of the key things that estrogen does is it keeps us insulin sensitive. So as cycling females, we are actually less at risk of developing insulin resistance and diabetes than men are, because we have that beautiful impact of estrogen in our body, keeping ourselves sensitive to insulin. As that drops off, our insulin sensitivity also decreases. So we become more insulin resistant through that time period. And we see this all the time. I look at a lot of blood work with our clients, and I just see this through the years as women go through perimenopause, their blood sugar markers and everything go up, and they don't even change their food. It's nothing to do with the food change. It's to do with the hormone change. And so what happens is, when we're no longer so insulin sensitive, it means we no longer can utilize carbs for fuel very efficiently. So you might not change the way you eat, you might still be eating the same amount of carbs, but you're basically just putting them in and your body doesn't get access to them. So not only will you stay feeling hungry and you'll stay feeling low on energy, but those carbs that are going in will get stored as body fat. And because of the testosterone, they'll generally get stored as belly fat rather than fat anywhere else in your body. And then if we move on to the next slide, the bizarre link here is that they both work together. So as insulin goes up, testosterone production goes up. And as testosterone goes up, insulin goes up. So it becomes this snowballing thing once it gets out of control. And then eventually, over time, as we kind of get into that very low hormone state of menopause, we might see that it sort of drops off again and our body actually adapts to it. But there, this is again where we need to understand what's happening so we can understand what changes we need to make to support our body to go through this natural transition.
Yeah, and this is an important point. You know, as you said before, you and I have both looked at blood work where they've eaten the same for the last 20 years, but these numbers are now changing, right? So it might not be that you're changing what you're eating at all, but your body's changed significantly. So it's really where addressing what used to work 20 years ago is not the same now, and that those roles of hormones do play quite a large role in things like insulin sensitivity, which is your body's ability to really either utilize that carbohydrate as fuel or store it as body fat, right? So knowing that it's such a powerful hormone, and then addressing those tweaks in how we eat, simply knowing that what's happened to our body is impacting how we digest the same foods, just in a really different way.
Mm, And it was just, I just sent a question in the comments there. Is this why I crave sugary treats? It absolutely can be, because the thing is, if you're putting in a fuel your body can't access, so your body's feeling tired, your body is going to search for more. So it can absolutely be a reason why we're kind of getting those cravings coming through, because you feel like you're feeling well, but actually you're not getting the benefit from it. So you're just going to stay hungry. And potentially as that gets worse, you'll feel more and more like sugar, which is technically a quick energy, but not doing us any good.
But your body can't use it. And we've used the analogy of the fuel tanker in the past, haven't we? Where, you know, we're eating this food, but our body can't access it. And we're kind of like the fuel tanker going down the road. We've got all this fuel that we're carrying along, but we're still having to pop off at the petrol station along the way. And it's where we start to bring in these snacks, right? We're grazing away. And as Jean's mentioned, and Lee now too, is the sugary treats or the chips or whatever, just to kind of keep those snacks going through the day. And it becomes really, really prominent through this phase, because Mandy, as she's mentioned, is your body's ability to utilize those carbohydrates aren't the same. So our body's just trying to find a way to pick up that energy gap.
Absolutely.
Cool. So what we're seeing really come through, and I mentioned it really briefly before, is taking the time to really support, don't force. And there's a conversation that we're having here that hopefully is happening a little bit deeper than simply, you know, eating less food and training harder, right? We really want to get away from that space. And, you know, we've got a couple of clients joining us on the call today, which is fantastic. And we can quite confidently say that, you know, we're at least over half of our female clients are dropping body fat by eating more food, right? More frequently, higher quality foods, and fueling the body, supporting the body to get their body to go through that shift. And it's really just addressing a couple of layers deeper down. What's happening hormonally? What's happening stress and sleep-wise? And really diving into, as we're kind of touching on quite heavily today and will continue to, is that metabolic shift and how timing is going to play a huge role in how we eat and when we eat. So hopefully we will absolutely dive into that today, but just wanted to give you that backstory first. And I think Mandy explains it really eloquently, is just to walk through that process of actually supporting the body, feeling like you're in control again a little bit. So let's go through, and I've already mentioned this concept of shifting how we fuel, and we'll dive into that timing component next, but you've mentioned it. I just want to go a little bit deeper into that fueling aspect, Mandy.
Yeah, so the thing is here is that our food environment is set up to be very carb dominated. It's very easy to spend your whole day going, you know, it's toast for breakfast and maybe a sandwich for lunch and then maybe some pasta for tea. And there's two components to what we really need to shift here. And I don't know, you'll have to pull me back out with Ollie because I'll go way down this pathway. there's the protein component first, but then there's also just allowing our body to adapt to using fat for fuel. So, and this is another male-female kind of difference, is that males do typically burn fat for fuel in a resting state much easier than females. So as our body moves to that slightly lower female hormone space and we're kind of having that bit of testosterone going on there, our body is actually slowly moving to a place again where we burn fat for fuel quite well, and we're not burning carbohydrates for fuel so well. And now our body knows how to do this. Our body was born knowing how to do this. Babies are very good at switching between glucose and fat. Breast milk is like mostly fat and has a small amount of sugars in it. And so the baby's bodies know how to use that fat and as energy. And then as we go through life, we tend to become, because of perhaps our food environment or whatever, we become very carbohydrate driven. So our body gets very good at going down this carbohydrate quick energy pathway. And then as insulin sensitivity drops off and we can no longer access that energy from carbohydrates quite the same, our body needs to remember how to go down that fat burning pathway. And this is kind of where that whole keto discussion comes in, though that's not what we're advocating, but it's the switch the other way of allowing our body to relearn how to use that slower, more steady state fuel that is fat. And that means that not only can we burn potentially body fat if we're not wanting it, but also using fat in our diet rather than having meals that are all focused on carbohydrates.
Yeah. And it's just, as you mentioned, right, taking the time to understand the ratio of these two and also what we'll dive into, a timing component. We're not removing one entirely. And I think this, we've seen many people going from vegetarian to carnivore, or from high carb to low carb, and this drastic shift in how we feel our body isn't very helpful and is ultimately stressful in a lot of different ways. So we'll say as well now that many members find that adding carbohydrates in their last meal or some point in their day, they find very helpful at calming and improving sleep quality. And we'll definitely dive into the role of carbohydrates too. It's definitely not removing this, but understanding the role of fat and knowing how we can shift the way we fuel our body is pretty significant.
Yeah, our body is wired for survival, and that means that we are designed to be able to use lots of different fuels. We can just get very good at using one and kind of forget how to use the other. And the whole insulin sensitivity thing is a really important part of that, because it's something we can really change through dietary choices and lifestyle and stuff like that. Is if we continue to go down that path of eating lots and lots of carbohydrates to get that quick energy source, which we may no longer access, we actually worsen our insulin resistance, which means we're going to find it even harder over time to access that fuel. So doing things back the other way, where we're using protein and we're using some good quality fats in our diet and we're getting more exercise and movement and stuff like that and sleeping better, we can actually improve our sensitivity to insulin, so that when you do put a few carbohydrates in, you actually get the benefit from it rather than it just being converted into fat.
Totally. Yeah, cool. So let you get a breath in there, Mandy. That was one big sentence. Is I want to give you a little bit of an action step around what this looks like from a metabolic flexibility component. And Lou, you've mentioned this now, and we want to really make sure we tie this into actionable steps you can actually take. So one of the concepts that we utilize quite heavily inside of our body reset programs is realizing how much an asset this can truly be, right? The concept of metabolic flexibility that we utilize can be kind of summarized as your body's ability to, or your ability to program your body to use fats as fuel better. And now what this means is when you wake up, we've already been in a state of fasting for say 8 to 10 hours, right? And just a little side tangent, but there's a lot of benefits coming out around the benefits of fasting, but to what degree is that really beneficial? Because all of you are fasting at some level, right? 8, 9, maybe 10 hours, maybe up to 12. But if we start going 14, 16, 18, there's going to be a point of diminishing return quite significantly, and especially through this phase. But when you start to eat, what are you choosing to fuel your body with can now impact your brain function and your energy throughout the rest of the day. So as Lou has mentioned, with things like oats for breakfast or cereal or more of a carbohydrate dominant breakfast, we don't tend to see that as being a particularly helpful option, right? And this really goes against the beliefs around, you know, carbohydrates being fuel. You know, got to have your banana in your morning smoothie. But when we start to remove those fructose and glucose options or carbohydrates, we start to see a huge improvement in your body's ability to sustain energy throughout the day, specifically through this phase. Okay. So understanding that for me personally works really well. Okay. Rather than having my pancakes at breakfast, I'm taking the time to be a little bit better with my morning smoothie or some sort of higher protein, higher fat breakfast, and allowing my carbohydrates to be later in the day. And taking the time to look at how that shifts fueling the day can be really, really big. So that's my two cents on that, Mandy, before you give me a little bit more context. But your body's ability to program to use fats as fuel for more of the day can be a really big difference.
Yeah, so in the morning, because like you say, we've had that overnight fast, our body is already in a place where it is kind of right on the cusp of using fats for fuel really well. So we can actually continue that benefit by keeping breakfast more focused on the protein, which is very blood sugar balancing, and those fats for fuel, rather than just putting a whole lot of carbs in right at the get-go. Now, this is a trend that I see all the time with people coming in, or that I've worked with over the years, and that is that they start the day with carbohydrates, you get a blood sugar spike and maybe an energy spike, you come crashing down at about 11 o'clock and then you need to eat a muffin or something like that to spike you back up again, and then you come crashing down at 2 o'clock, and it just kind of goes on this roller coaster through the day. And as soon as you take that out, as soon as you swap out that carbohydrate-y start to the day for something like some protein and some good quality fat and some vegetables in there, it just stabilizes the whole day. You literally set your day up for success by starting with something that stabilizes your blood sugar. And I mean, there's so many layers to this, because when you wake up in the morning, your cortisol is high. Cortisol is a stress hormone, and causes our body to release stored glucose. So it actually elevates our blood sugar. So if you then go on through carbohydrates on top of that, like a cereal or some toast, you're actually getting this much more elevated spike than you might if you eat that same carbohydrate later in the day. So it really comes down to understanding these very kind of intricate pathways that are going on inside your body to know when to best fuel with different types of fuel.
Yeah, we're getting a couple of light bulb moments in the chat here, Mandy, so I'm glad that this is helpful. Was there anything else to add in just before I dive down this route?
We haven't really gone onto the protein thing. Do we want to talk about that a little bit there?
I think we can probably dive in, yeah, this next bit, right? And I think the big one, and this is an overall observation, as Mandy mentioned, we've over the last, even last 2 or 3 years, we've worked with over 1,000 clients, and a large majority of them being female. One of the big tweaks that we've seen there is simply from a nourishing front, what can we really shift? And a common mention on our side has very much been, make sure that you fuel, don't starve. Like if you want to change your body, you want to change how you feel on a day-to-day basis, fuel, don't starve. Whereas we mentioned before, support, don't starve. And we really see this as being a prominent problem. Is we'd say, and this is a pretty conservative number, we think, is around 60 to 70% of our members coming in are under eating, right? They're trying to drop body fat. They're trying to shift their body. Maybe it might be digestive wise or even energy focus. There might not even be a fat loss component to it, but we're chronically under eating. So the protein component that Mandy's just mentioned is a significant part of this, but really just taking the time to not push yourself into the corner of eating less and less and less, you just start to back yourself into a corner. And Melody's just mentioned the fasting component, and we've actually done full topic trainings for our long-term members and stuff around how to do this effectively and to what degree. But the trouble is at a very basic level, if you restrict the window to which you're eating, it's just going through that first rung of let's restrict your calories, right? So if you're burning at say 2000 calories and you eat at 2000 calories, that's our rough maintenance, right? If we drop down to 1600, we'll drop body fat for say 2 weeks, maybe, provided our body's healthy or toxicity levels and all the other things that we'll look at. But if we continue, and our body will now adjust down to that new level. So if we go 1600, then 1200, then 1000, then 800, we just start breaking the body down. We push ourselves into a corner where things are not functioning very well. We don't have the energy. Our immune system's not working particularly well. And now we're in a survival spot where our body's going to hold on to body fat anyway, right? So seeing that increase in our improvement of fueling our body, adding a bit more proteins and fats, as we're mentioning today, that makes a pretty big difference.
Yeah, you can't expect to increase your energy output or your mood output, all that sort of stuff, when you're reducing the input all the time. And that's what we do. Like it's so, like this is so deeply wired into our psyche that if you're wanting to lose weight, eat less. Like it's so deeply embedded there. It is always the first thought, even if it's very subconscious. But the reality is you have to fuel first so that you can move better second, and it starts with really fueling well rather than fueling less.
100%. If there's any questions, guys, I can see that there's a bit more chatter coming through. So please just chuck a couple of questions in the chat and we will certainly just come around to it in a second. I just want to go through one more slide here, but really that ability to, as Mandy mentioned, just the ability to nourish that and really start to get towards a healthy weight. I think Nicole was a really good example here where she was in a position where she, over the course of a year or so, had continued to drop her calories down further and further, right? It was a classic approach, let's train really, really hard and let's eat less and less. Her entire focus for the first month is stop looking at calories and start to count colors, right? And if that's not something you've gone through in the body reset, and that's something that you can start with, we even had a beautiful photo, Mandy, I'm not sure if you saw it last week, but a member posted up a photo of this is what my meals have looked like for the week, and just color was a really cool way to just adjust how they were eating, how they were enjoying food again, and taking the time to get that body to work well again, right? So not only did we double the amount of calories overall that she was eating, we weren't tracking it at all. We just, by the way, what are you eating? And we started to realize that was double where it was. She started to drop body fat. Her strength went up. She got 2 job promotions, but I thought it was really, really cool because we started to see that clarity, that mental focus, as the first half of our conversation today has been about. And then she saw her strength and her motivation and her training environment go through the roof as well, because it comes back to all of those, not necessarily non-tangible, but maybe not the focus points of better mood, better energy, better focus that really started to improve how that body works. So hopefully that first part of today is powerful for you and allows you to as Mandy mentioned, not just fall back to the default of my body's not shifting, so I'm going to eat less. I'm going to skip this meal. I'm going to leave half of this in my plate, whatever it might be, and start to address how this body is actually working and how we can make some of those shifts. So if there's a couple of questions, team, we can certainly circle around here. I want to be mindful of time, but I just want to make sure that while we're on the topic, before we dive into specific symptoms and some of those key points coming through there, I'd love to know what you want me to cover or what you want us to cover from that body fat or metabolic shift focus. I'll let you read them, Mandy.
Yeah, Lynn in here said about choosing protein first and adding carbs and fats around it. And I love that approach. That is the approach we should be taking to every meal, is that every meal is an opportunity to meet your protein needs, and protein is the macronutrient that's going to balance our blood sugar, keep our muscle mass there, keep our hormones balanced, all those sorts of things. Choose that first and then add in the other things around that, rather than it being looking at perhaps the meal that you're going to eat and then hoping it kind of fits into those targets, but actually being quite intentional about it is very cool.
I think that was the only question. I did have one earlier. There was mostly like, this is making sense, all of the rest, which is great. Melanie, we mentioned your question around intermittent fasting. Is this helpful? And that I don't feel hungry before 11 a.m. I'll let you tackle that one, Mandy.
Yeah, the hunger before 11 a.m. Not hungry before 11 a.m. is a really common one. Two reasons. One, when you stop eating breakfast, your body economizes. So if you're not going to put food in, it's not going to turn up your digestive enzymes. It's not going to turn up your hunger hormones. It's not going to turn up your stomach acid, because it knows there's no food coming. So if you do it often enough, you will lose your hunger drive in the morning. Okay. So that's a big part of it. And something we do a lot with clients is just start eating something small. Okay. And your body will respond and it will come back to feeling hungry then. Okay. Not feeling hungry. I'm really surprised. It's very often I hear people like, oh, I just don't feel hungry, and it's really good. It's like, well, actually, a healthy body should feel hungry. We should feel hungry, because that's our driver to get food, which keeps us functioning well. So if you're not feeling hungry until around about 11 o'clock, a lot of that will just be habit, and you can choose to change that if you want to. But the other part of that is that our body is, our circadian rhythm is designed, and our whole body functions on circadian time clock. And our body is most responsive to foods coming in the days, in the light hours of the day, and particularly in the morning. So if we're wasting a significant portion of the day and not eating, and then pushing our eating window out until late at night, we're actually further upsetting some of the problem that is occurring. So actually, getting yourself back to eating earlier in the day and maybe stopping earlier in the night is a much better option. And our body in particular is very sensitive to protein in the morning. So a general rule is protein before 10. Have some protein before 10, because your body will use that to build muscle and all of those other things that it's going to do more efficiently at that time. It's kind of like the fasting discussion. It's not that it is bad. It's that context matters, and actually bringing that window back a little bit and getting some protein in earlier in the day, your body will respond to you with so much better energy after a while.
Yeah, and I think the big shift here as well, Mandy, is, you know, we're not doing a keto plan or a Mediterranean plan or a fasting plan. We're doing a Mandy plan or a Selena plan, you know, whatever that might be, Selena plan or Lee plan or whatever it might be. So it's just getting an idea of what you feel best on. And we're seeing this come through as, you know, what about honey or what about fruit, et cetera. And I think just understanding we're looking at a very simple, but a metabolic standpoint from simply those three macronutrient groups. So from a protein standpoint, we're looking at our main meat groups. We're looking at any sort of protein powders you're having, provided you digest them well, things like eggs, et cetera, that it becomes our key protein source. When we're looking at our fruits and honeys, although there's other benefits in coming through, I think a lot of confusion gets thrown out there when we find a new superfood or there's an antioxidant in there. And although honey and fruits have fantastic benefits, we need to first look at the fructose and sugar content that's disrupting this metabolic window component as well. So looking at things like your fruits and your honeys and your sun-kissed coconut sugars, whatever it might be, and taking the time to realize it's still a sugar at the end of the day is going to impact how our body operates, I think is a really nice way to just address simplifying it down, because there's some incredibly good marketing companies out there with a health tick that they've managed to pay for on the side of their box that isn't actually particularly helpful for you. So that's an important point to put in there too. Cool.
It's the dose that makes the poison, right?
Yes.
You know, a small amount and it might be okay in the context of a really good diet, but if that's making up the bulk of your diet, maybe of something that looks really good is not actually beneficial for you. So.
Yeah. So we're going to dive a little bit deeper into to finish off today and to make sure we've got some awareness of what symptoms are coming through and how we can address this a little bit more. We were having a good chat about this, Mandy, around 10 o'clock, getting ready for today. And we were talking about making sure we talked about the importance of the symptoms coming through and what's actually happening here. Because when we start to worry so much about the one thing by itself in isolation, rather than really truly addressing the root cause, which is all of these things combined, we're not supporting the body. We're just trying to address an issue without looking at the full picture. All right. So when these are an acute solution, but we don't take the time to look at what part of this journey we're really going through, it can be a little bit vague. So before we dive into specific symptoms, Mandy, was there anything you wanted to address here?
It's really, if we pull this really back around to this perimenopausal, menopausal change and that chart that we looked at the start, that graph with those fluctuating hormones, it is a time when our whole body is going through basically a recalibration. Everything is a bit destabilized, our energy, perhaps our mood, our gut function, every system in our body is destabilized for a time during this process. So rather than kind of hyper-focusing on perhaps one symptom, it's actually looking at the body as a whole and knowing that there is changes that are going on throughout the whole body through this time, and what can we do to actually support it to go through this transition. And like I said right back at the start, this is a natural transition for the body. The body knows what it's doing here. We just have to help it through this stage by looking after it as best we can. So the whole support, don't force thing, you're not wanting to increase the stress or starve yourself or any of these things to try and sort the problem out. We're just trying to minimize as much as we can the impact of that destabilization. And then just keeping in mind that this is a patch of time that you're going through, things will balance out after a time. And we may not actually be able to shorten that time. Menopause and that whole transition is very genetic, so depending on what your mother or your aunties or whatever went through, often that will have some kind of link to how you might experience it. But we can improve how we go through that transition by what we do on a daily basis.
Yeah, cool. I was just going to reply to Connie, but that addressing sleep and stress together is certainly something we'll touch on a fair bit as well.
So
the first one that we saw come through quite a lot, Mandy, was this awareness of hot flushes, right? And I think why we gave it context of this whole process of is it cause or symptom is realizing that hot flushes are a symptom, they're not the cause, and that we can start to address how much of those nutritional and lifestyle factors will have an impact on how the body works is allowing us to really address the full picture and mitigate or improve some of these symptoms coming through. So going back to the chart, and I think that's probably a really valuable visualization for today, was understanding that these disruptions in estrogen and progesterone are really playing a role in them. I want to go deeper on this, but I think you framed it really well earlier today.
The hot flushes is probably the belly fat storage and hot flushes are the sort of like the two biggest, most common across the board symptoms that are felt through perimenopause and menopause. The link here is that it is largely to do with the fluctuation of estrogen. There was, for a time, it was thought to be the decline in estrogen, but it's actually not that, because often when people enter menopause after a year or two, they no longer get the hot flushes anymore. So it's not actually to do with estrogen being low, it's to do with estrogen fluctuating. And estrogen fluctuates significantly in the first, the early stages of perimenopause, and then that tends to go up and down throughout.
Where was it? This one.
So we can see that there's these massive peaks and troughs of estrogen initially, with estrogen going significantly higher than perhaps it has ever been. So it's these massive peaks and falls which can really stimulate that kind of some of the beginning stages of those hot flushes.
Sorry, I disrupted you now.
That's all right. Get back to that one. And part of why this triggers it is that our brain has a component in it where it knows what our normal body temperature is, and it allows us to have a certain degree of variation within our normal body temperature before it triggers us to really kind of cool the body down. Okay, so we have, say, you know, it's called the thermoregulatory range. So we have a range. Estrogen allows that range to be a certain gap, and as our brain is adapting to the new changes in hormone levels, that gap actually narrows. So it means a smaller temperature shift in our body causes our body to have this huge reaction, which is we need to cool down. And so you get hot and you get flushed and you get sweaty and stuff like that to cool the body down. So it's basically the brain overreacting to a very small change because it's learning to deal with new lower hormone levels. And the really interesting component that I thought was so interesting here is that the stress hormone noradrenaline, which is one that our adrenal glands make, if we are significantly exposed to this hormone, that actually further reduces this range here. So what this means is that going into perimenopause and into menopause, if your stress levels have been significantly high for whatever reason, maybe it's financial stress, maybe it's just life stresses, maybe it's an ongoing chronic kind of health stress or something like that that's significantly peaking these stress hormones all the time, that can actually make the hot flushes and stuff a whole lot worse. So when we want to look at like minimizing these, it's actually coming back to looking at all those things that calm the body down and allow it to go through that process and change without having those, you know, kind of ins and outs and ups and downs all the time. So it really comes back to central nervous system management and managing our stress levels and all of those sorts of things.
One of the things that came up in the chat a couple of times there is you mentioned your body's ability to resensitize around this deep stabilization of hormones, right? So seeing estrogen go up, seeing it plummet, all of these things, and seeing how that has a significant impact to serotonin, as we mentioned earlier, and taking the time to look at how that's going to drastically impact both mood and sleep quality, it's going to have a huge impact to that mood aspect as well. Lynn, we are going to mention things around HRT, both perimenopause and menopause, and what impact that's truly going to have. And knowing that it's going to have a very different impact in perimenopause to menopause, right? Because the whole process here is not to keep hormones high. That's not the goal. It's to make sure they come down in a fashion that doesn't disrupt things too much. So addressing the ability to allow your body to normalize lower estrogen and how your body feels at those levels is actually the goal.
Yeah. Absolutely. Letting your body adapt to that slowly. And everyone is different, and depending on how you come into perimenopause is going to change how you experience that. For example, if you come into perimenopause having been on, say, the oral contraceptive pill, something like that, which has kept estrogen, synthetic estrogen, high and there being no progesterone, then if you suddenly come off that in a low estrogen state, you might have like quite significant hot flushes for a time as your body get used to that. So there's a whole lot of varying factors to how your body's going to experience that transition as those hormones decline.
So a big part of that as well, Mandy, is, you know, based on what contraceptive you may have been on in the past, it has had a significant impact, not always positive or very rarely positive, around how your body now tolerates this new phase.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Finally, we're starting to see, you know, more bioidentical hormones used and starting to understand the use of both and balancing both. But, you know, especially through the 90s and early 2000s, that was a significant issue, and where a lot of those symptoms got really, really bad, and now is now having an impact through that phase. So addressing this is certainly not common knowledge. And hopefully today, I know we're going deep, we're understanding some science behind it, but hopefully it looks like you're enjoying it, to just really get some context around why that body's operating the way it is now. Cool. We did have a second slide on that, but you did pretty much touch on everything there. This, I guess, dives a little bit more into action steps directly.
Yeah. So, I mean, the big thing with the hot flushes, and I'm talking about this in particular, but this goes to as well to, you know, the sleep disturbance and even weight gain and all those things. But it's really about supporting the central nervous system and calming everything down and minimizing stress so that we can keep that thermoregulatory zone as wide as possible. But so you very simple habits like some yoga, some walking outside and some breath work and stuff like that is really, really helpful. We underestimate the power of these things all the time, but they're so valuable. And minimizing alcohol. And unfortunately, this is a pretty unpopular popular one, but alcohol becomes that thing that you go to wind down because you are maybe more stressed, but it massively impacts your how your nervous system responds over time, and it's really not doing any help at this time of life. Supporting our body, our energy stability, and again, that comes back to that metabolic flexibility that we talked about, and utilizing the fuel that our body is going to burn well. So that's your fats, lots and lots and lots of vegetables and color, and the protein in there. And then a couple of supplement wise, magnesium is really helpful, just calming the brain down. Taurine is another one. That's an amino acid. And then herb wise, there's one called black cohosh. This is the most studied herb for hot flushes and stuff. And there does seem to be some impact for some people. It's not a magic pill, but it does work for some people.
Mm. Wow. We had a couple of people mention from the stress standpoint, we'll definitely dive into that a little bit more about how you apply that rather than just like, don't be stressed, which isn't helpful. What are some steps that you can take into account to improve stress tolerance, which I think is a huge part, right? Stress isn't a level, but a threshold. And it's important to see that this threshold has been lowered naturally, and hence why we need to address it a little bit more, because again, things like stress before are going to impact you very differently. And as Laura's just mentioned, caffeine is going to be also an impact on stress as well. So we're not going to come back to who've mentioned it before, chips, alcohol and coffee, but addressing your caffeine intake will have a big picture on it, right? Because you are looking at a cup of cortisol. And again, cortisol is not bad by any means. As Mandy mentioned, we actually need cortisol to wake up effectively in the morning. And it also around training time can be something that is elevated, you know, and is an important part of that. But addressing caffeine as being an all-day thing or stress as being an all-day thing is not how our body's designed. It's these spurts that are required, but not long-term chronic stress that's going to be an issue. So the big one that came through here, and as many of you know, a big part of our conversations around gut health and digestion, and it's not what you eat, it's what you absorb, will be a big topic of day two on Wednesday. But just addressing food sensitivities, because it is something that becomes really prominent through this perimenopause and menopausal phase, is seeing how foods interact differently with your body and how things that used to feel absolutely fine are now causing bloating or gassiness or just low energy. And part of that may be the metabolic aspect that we mentioned. You're not fueling the body with the foods that are adequate, but there's a sensitivity aspect that tends to come through a little bit more. And it seems to be that decrease in progesterone tends to reduce things like your immune system and how things are functioning on a day-to-day basis. So developing, you know, chronic immune conditions or those autoimmune conditions that are coming through tend to start to come on the rise. And it's simply because our body's not as good at fighting away the stuff as it used to be, all right? So when we start to see this decrease in progesterone, we start to see that food sensitivity start to increase. Now, if you do this alongside something like heightened stress that's happening all day, and we're not able to tolerate or mitigate high stress phases, right? Regulate or calm ourselves down after being stressed, then we're eating in a stress state as well, which just makes that twice as bad. So if you notice that those come through, it's certainly something that's coming through more relevant. And I mentioned it, I believe, in the chat before, but a decrease in estrogen actually has a significant impact on serotonin as well. And serotonin, I think about 90% of that is made in your gut. That's going to have a huge impact on your mood. It's going to have a huge impact on your sleep because it's precursor to melatonin. And it's also going to have a big impact on that stress or that resilience aspect as well. So hormonally, there is definitely an impact that comes through from food sensitivities, hence why addressing this quality versus quantity conversation is really important, because we're starting to look at what foods really fuel your day. If we're eating foods that are the right, you know, macronutrient quality, but they're not foods that you feel good on, maybe a whey protein or eggs or something that you've overdone for a really long time, you know, not to say any of those foods are bad, it's personal to you, where some of those issues really start to come through.
Yeah, there's definitely there's an increased risk during this time because, like I said before, the whole body is in some way slightly destabilized. So there is a risk for all sorts of things at this time if we aren't kind of listening to some of the messages that our body is sending us. And our gut health is key to everything. And the hormone changes do impact our gut. That seems kind of disconnected, but it's absolutely not. And so really looking after our gut health and not eating those foods that are causing problems, like Ollie's mentioned, maybe it's whey protein, maybe it's eggs, maybe it's dairy, who knows what it could be for you. But continuing to eat things that are perhaps not digesting really well can become more problematic at this time if your gut health is not feeling too happy. And the flow on is that if your gut's unhappy, inflammation increases, and inflammation then worsens all those symptoms that you're already potentially experiencing. So it comes again quite circular.
Yeah. Awesome, guys. So I'm aware of time. I just want to make sure that from today, hopefully we're starting to set the foundation of what we're going to go through this week. And I do want you to really utilize that menopause reset group to allow us to dive a bit deeper into this. As you can tell, Mandy's an absolute walking encyclopedia of knowledge, and hopefully I can help simplify, refine further, or simply clarify points. But the goal of this is not simply digestive or just physical or even psychological. It's understanding the integration of all three. And what is the part of that that you need to address? Because we've mentioned physical, and we certainly will a lot more in Wednesday's training around what is your sweet spot of activity. It's not that we shouldn't exercise, or we should always exercise. It's to what degree and what type of exercise is going to be helpful. And I think many of us are still doing maybe the circuit class or spin class or the long run that may be unhelpful. And how can we find a way to balance this out depending on what you enjoy and what's going to get the results that you're truly after? We're looking at the psychological. How are we able to tolerate stress? How are we looking at how we can improve that resilience to stress? And as we briefly mentioned today, and we'll dive into a lot more tomorrow, is around that digestive aspect. It's not just what you eat, it's what you absorb. And if there's sensitivities coming through that weren't there before, how can we start to address this with your new biology? So overall, the goal here is really just to find that missing puzzle piece. There's a lot going on, as you can tell. Hopefully today allowed you to create some real context. I am aware it was quite sciencey, and hopefully that was beneficial, but it was really to give you some context on where we're going and why we're doing what we're doing, because it's no longer just a, hey, eat this, or here's a new superfood. I think you've had more than enough of that. And now it's a case of understanding your personal blueprint, understanding what your food should look like on a day-to-day basis, and finding that missing puzzle piece. Okay. So we are happy to stay around for a couple minutes and answer any other questions that you have. Hopefully that was a great day one to really understand some of those steps coming through.